So are you excited to talk about this dog book?
You know, I have thoughts, I have feelings. Uh-huh. It's an interesting book. I'm not sure. We'll get into it, I guess. Yeah. I'm not sure it will ever be my favorite, or even in the top three, but it is a really odd book.
Yeah, I have read it several times now in the past year, and each time I've kind of picked up on something new from it. So who do we want to do the opening narration?
I don't know.
Do you want me to just do it?
Why don't you just do it? Let's just get this done.
I'll do it right now.
Okay.
Henry Huggins' dog, Ribsy, was a plain, ordinary city dog. The kind of dog that strangers usually called Mutt or Pooch. They always called him this in a friendly way because Ribsy was a friendly dog. He followed Henry and his friends to school, he kept the mailman company, he wagged his tail at the milkman who always stopped to pet him. People liked Ribsy, and Ribsy liked people. Ribsy was what you might call a well-adjusted dog.
You've just heard the opening lines to Beverly Cleary's Ribsy. I'm John McCoy.
I'm Phil Gonzalez.
And you're listening to Click It Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast. Okay, so this is 1964's Ribsy.
Ribsy, the strange experimental Ribsy. I mean, not the character of the book.
1964, the year the Beatles came to America.
And it shows... No, it doesn't actually. Like, there's no indication in this book that there's a grand cultural shift occurring in the nation.
But there is a grand cultural shift occurring in Cleary. This is a really strange book. I will be honest. When I tried to read this as a kid, and I found it just not sitting well with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't read it, I think, all the way through until I had kids. And then I didn't think too much of it. I just thought, huh, that was an odd book.
Yeah.
And I put it back on the shelf. However, I do have a lovely copy of the book. It's a weekly reader's edition that has all the Lois Starling illustrations that it's just a gorgeous, and he does some really gorgeous illustrations for this,
especially beginning the book off with a anatomical drawing of a flea.
Exactly.
Like the first thing your first impression visually of this book is, so you hear a little bit about this flea that's constantly attacking Ribsy in this one spot that he can't reach, and it semi-anthropomorphizes this flea. But the drawing is very much a realistic, blown-up image of an actual flea. I mean, you expect like a little cartoon flea with like a little napkin tied around his neck and like a knife and a fork in his hand. And
the flea is the instigating character of this book, and it's a remarkable book. In you've alluded to this several times throughout the course of the podcast. This is Cleary's attempt to get inside the mind of Ribsy and mm-hmm. to treat that with some seriousness in that she is going to try to present phenomenologically what might be going on inside a dog's head.
Right, without adding anything to the personality of a dog. Without presuming any kind of knowledge beyond what we can assume a dog would actually think or experience. Like there's no, to the extent that halfway through this book, Ribsy pretty much forgets about Henry, which I find fast. Like this is to me, a more quote unquote, like realistic portrayal of the inside of an animal's head than like the plague dogs. Like she simplifies everything for Ribsy.
To the point that nearly, I would say, two-thirds of the book is told in indirect narration. You know, there is dialogue,
mm-hmm.
And there are some odd shifts in point of view. There are times where the point of view shifts away from Ribsy back to Henry. And yes. In those passages, it's just sort of like, oh, here's a little miniature scene with Henry Huggins.
Right.
Most of the time when Ribsy is with people, the dialogue is highly simplified and Ribsy's reaction is not one of understanding. It's like, it's that Ribsy recognizes the tone of someone's voice.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Like, people talk to Ribsy like people talk to a dog. Like, there's not a whole lot of like, it's just you and me, pal, in this book. It's like, here's a dog and can I give a little rundown of the plot?
Please do.
Okay. So, in the story, a collarless Ribsy escapes the Huggins' station wagon one rainy afternoon at a shopping center, only to end up in the back seat of the wrong car. He's adopted by a family of singing schoolgirls and has to find his way back home to Henry, all the while facing the realities of life as a stray dog. He escapes a family of girls and is taken in by Mrs. Frawley, a kindly old woman who sees Ribsy as a replacement for her late husband, teaching him humiliating tricks and pampering him to the point of obesity. Mrs. Sonchek's second grade class, who are pleased to be allowed to have a mascot until Ribsy attacks a pet squirrel and is escorted out of the building by the principal. Joe Saylor Jr., an opportunistic kid who uses Ribsy for media attention, kind of. And Larry Biggerstaff, a poor boy whose single mom is constantly on the verge of eviction due to Larry's disruptive behavior in their apartment building. Throughout the book, Ribsy adjusts to life on the street, crashes a high school football game, and navigates a world hostile to even the friendliest dogs. Back home, Henry starts coming to terms with the possibility of never seeing his faithful companion again, and ultimately the two are reunited. The book returns to the status quo. However, the reader is left with a deeper insight into the mind of an otherwise silent character. It's a road trip. It's a road trip book.
It is a road trip book. It's also a return to Cleary's origins in that it's a highly picaresque book. There are these little vignettes, these little sequences, and then Ribsy moves on and we never see these people again.
Right.
And the other thing I would say is that as the book goes on, I found myself thinking the characters are getting broader and sillier as it goes along in a weird way. You know, as silly as the early scenes are, and they are pretty silly when Ribsy is taken in by the kindly old lady, or the family of girls, by the end the dialogue just becomes kind of perfunctory and zany. Everyone introduces themselves by saying, "Hey, your name, what are you doing here?" and everyone introduces their situation, and Junior is a little creep.
Yep. Well, it feels like as the book goes along, the characters become more and more oppressive. I don't think out of the entire book any of the new introduced characters are likable. They're all very in your face. They're all extreme in their behavior. The schoolgirls are just, they won't leave Ribsy alone. They're constantly pawing at him and singing at the top of their lungs. The second grade class, I guess the second grade class is probably like the easiest time he has because they don't expect much of him.
Right.
The old lady just, she's got her idea of what a dog is supposed to be and she just humiliates this poor animal and then like, I don't even know what Joe Saylor's deal is. He wants a dog, but he doesn't. Like he's like almost an Eddie Haskell type, in that he's just like this like crappy kid who lives down the street and like no one seems to like. And then Larry Biggerstaff isn't really even a character. He's just he is a way to get Ribsy onto a fire escape.
Well, Larry has a motivating arc, which is he just wants a good ball.
That's right. It is so sad. He can't even get a ball. His mom's like, "We don't have the money for a ball. Keep out of trouble. I'm going to work all day. Don't get in trouble. No, you can't have a new ball." It's probably the least probably the poorest character that Beverly Cleary has introduced so far.
Yeah. Now let's go back. Let's go back to the beginning for a second here, because part of the we talk about the instigating moment for this book where Ribsy is in the family station wagon and escapes. The thing that is interesting about this is, to me, is that at first the Hugginses don't want Ribsy in the brand new car, and Ribsy chases the car down. They finally allow him into the car, and I guess there is a this reminds me of in Henry and Ribsy way back when, the third book, when the whole plot line revolves around whether Ribsy is really a member of the family or not.
Yeah.
And the question is Ribsy really going to be allowed into the car or not? And ultimately, you know, if they had left him at home, he would have been okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that dog thing. It's that frustrating dog thing where Ribsy doesn't know what's best for him, and it's up to the family to determine. Like, there's nothing to be gained from taking a dog on a long car trip and then shunning it in the car for hours while you shop.
Right.
Like, nobody wins in that situation. At best, the dog is going to be sad. At worst, you're going to come home to a torn up brand new car.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that worried me about this. First of all, the fact that Ribsy is shut inside a car. I think today we all know better the dangers of pets being locked in cars. There's a funny bit here where Cleary spends a lot of time describing the shopping center, and I realize this is another mid-60s explanation of, oh, here's something new about urban life.
Yeah, there's a reason that people are coming from all points to this shopping center. Like, it's a hub. It's not a shopping center. It's the shopping center. And, so Ribsy gets picked up by a strange family who take him to the completely different side of town because this is the new shopping center. It's like a big deal.
Now, Ribsy gets out of the car by activating the new power windows on the automobile. Mm-hmm. And this struck me as wrong, because as a kid in the early 70s, I did not remember cars, any of them having automatic windows. So I looked up when were automatic windows installed into cars, and mm-hmm. I found that actually, no, they've been around since the late 50s, but only on really high-end cars. But here's the thing that I learned that I said, aha, which was the cars of this era, you couldn't roll down, you couldn't engage an automatic window unless the ignition was on.
I was wondering about that. It seemed a little fishy to me.
Yeah.
So did they leave the ignition on? Were they like, well, we got to keep Ribsy comfortable.
Right. Now, I think Beverly Cleary did not know how these things worked. And
a little artistic license.
Yes.
Yeah. Also, like, no one seems to have any problem leaving windows down on a presumably obviously rainy day, because it rains all day, but Ribsy still gets into a car with a window that's down.
Yeah.
But yeah, this whole section bugs me, not from a narrative perspective, but from a from the cavalier attitude of pet owners of the era. Like, it's, you're not taking good care of this dog. You're not taking good care of this dog.
Well, all through the book, we get to see different attitudes towards dogs, and a particularly cavalier attitude about strays.
Yeah.
Now, when I was, when was it? It was probably like 75 or 76 that the movie Benji came out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a movie that, you know, kids today have no knowledge of, but it was one of the top grossing films of that year.
Certainly one about, of the top grossing independent films of all time.
Right. It was about a small stray dog and his life wandering around a neighborhood and how everyone in town gave him a different name and treated him differently. And so that was still, I guess, the expectation by the mid-70s. Today, you know, if you saw, no one would put up with a stray animal wandering around the streets. They would immediately call animal control.
And if they found it, like, we have a different attitude towards found. Like, there is a desperate attempt these days to find the correct owner of a dog. And I would say that the characters in this book, they do run newspaper ads. Like, they do their due diligence as far as, like, trying to get Ribsy back to his home. Like,
except for Junior.
Except for Junior, who's a budding sociopath. I don't understand. And also has, like, the most frustrating moment of the book where Ribsy escapes him again.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that. I like what you said about, though, like, the book shows not only different people's attitudes towards dogs, it also shows, I was trying to come up with, like, what is the, like, to me, this is a book is kind of a little coda on the Henry Huggins series. Like, there's the Henry Huggins series, it came to a nice conclusion, and then there's this, and I was like, what's the point of this book? Like, where does it sit in the series? And to me, it seems more like a return to the beginning, like it's about the dog, but it also sort of works as a way of showing that, like, Henry is the perfect owner for Ribsy, and Ribsy is the perfect dog for Henry. In case you were wondering, like, whether these two had a real connection. So we're going to show you this by showing how different people respond to Ribsy and how he's not a good fit in any of these situations. How, like, only Henry Huggins is the person that he should be with. And I think that at the end, it does a nice job of sort of reassuring the readers that, like, don't worry, like, they've been through a lot together, but they're still a good, strong pairing.
I agree, but I also think that it does show Cleary really itching to try something else and go in different directions. And one of the great genius ways that Cleary does this is she takes the existing world of her books and then does something completely different with them. She's going to, of course, do that fantastically with Ramona in a little bit.
Yeah.
But here it's the reimagining of the relationship, and there's something fascinating to me now. As a kid, I didn't like it, but as an adult, there's something fascinating about taking the primary character from your book and shutting it over to one side. You know, mm-hmm. Now that I'm older, I recognize that as something authors do all the time.
Right.
But it was weird for me as a kid. You know, it was the first time I'd ever seen that. And it was also really weird, this constant rattling around in Ribsy's head and the way in which she's really going to constrain our understanding of the situation to Ribsy's understanding of the situation.
Yeah. No, I agree with you on all that. I think that it's an odd choice. Maybe it is makes sense, though, from an artistic perspective, because she's spent so many books now really digging into the psyche of, like, the teenage characters in her teen books and really justifying the way the teen mind works. I guess the next logical step would be, like, okay, I convinced you I know how teens tick. Let's, like, dig into an even simpler animal. And, like, I'll prove to you I know how a four-legged mammal can think. I mean, maybe if she had kept on this, we would have gotten back to that flea. Like, we would have had this very experimental, minimalist children's book about, like, the mind of an insect.
Right. I suppose that when you think about it as being constrained by Ribsy's understanding and point of view, it makes sense that all the characters in this book are so broad and so wacky with their actions, because you can't really sustain a dog's point of view and then have a complex human actor. It would really mess with your point of view. I guess that we as the reader, we're in a privileged position where we understand the motivations of the people, but the people have barely any motivation at all in this book. People tend to be motivated by like, oh, free dog.
Right. Well, and we're only let into the moments in the people's lives more or less when they are interacting with Ribsy. So we're not, she does, I guess Cleary does give us a little background on some of the people. Like, we understand that like Mrs. Frawley's husband has died and she's very lonely. And we understand that like Joe Saylor's sister likes to torment him with her piano playing. Like, we're let in on a few of these things. We understand that Larry Biggerstaff is a poor, sad kid with no ball, but I guess that's really all we know about Larry Biggerstaff. But we are confined to only the actions that occur immediately in the vicinity of this one dog. And when people are around this strange dog, they tend to only interact with the dog. And we know we never got the Joe Saylor offshoot novel.
You know, a little Joe goes a really long way.
He really does. He's an awful boy.
But you know, but Mrs. Frawley is also a kind of a very sad character. You know,
she's horrible. Like, I don't dislike Mrs. Frawley. I feel terrible for her. Like, because not only is she utterly alone, she's like desperate to be on top of like the old ladies' club. It's a sad, sad chapter. I skimmed over it the last time I read it because it makes me feel kind of bad. Well, so he gets taken to the house of these very energetic girls, and you had an issue with one of their names.
Oh, right. One of their names is Zibby, and I couldn't figure out what that was, and then I looked up that it is yet another diminutive of Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And this bugs me because Elizabeth already has like 7 or 8 diminutives. You know, it's got Eliza, it's got Liz, it's got Bitsy, Betsy,
mm-hmm. Ellie.
Ellie Lizard.
Zeb. Zeb is actually, I know a person who goes by Zeb. Her name is Elizabeth.
It kind of angered me that there's just one more.
It's a good 4-syllable name, though. You got a lot of options.
Well, anyway, I'd never heard of anyone named Zibby before in my life, and at first, I wasn't exactly sure what gender this was, but she's the eldest, right? She's the one who's the most excited by the idea of having a dog in the house.
They are allowed free rein on this poor dog's like emotional health as they throw him in the bathtub and wash him with bubble bath and just and attempt to dry him off by driving around in a car with the heat on full blast. Okay, the thought of like putting like 5 people in a car and a wet dog, rolling up the windows and turning on the heat as high as it will go, sounds like the worst possible thing you can do with a family.
Yeah. But
like that part makes me physically itchy just to read about.
Yeah, I have to say, reading this through, there was a kind of an impatience I felt in this book, which was like I felt like I got the what was happening in each sequence, and there wasn't that typical Cleary, now we're going to build to a crazy, zany end.
Yeah.
In a lot of these sequences, I suppose the centerpiece of this is Ribsy getting a bath and mm-hmm. smelling like violets, and that's going to be a big, I guess, a big concern for Ribsy because he doesn't like to smell like violets. But
he doesn't.
But I just didn't.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's like the chapters all go on a little bit longer than they need to.
Yeah,
like it should end with him smelling like violets and then escaping, but instead we get the long car ride and another song. Yeah. And yeah, there's it seems to each chapter spins its wheels a little bit. Like, you can kind of figure out, you know, that Ribsy's going to get away each time, and that's kind of just how each chapter ends, is just Ribsy running off.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the girls. Mrs. Frawley, though, tell us about sad Mrs. Frawley.
So, yeah. Well, on the way to Mrs. Frawley, Ribsy runs into another dog, and that's a kind of an interesting little segment because we get to see two dogs squaring each other off. It's very quick, but there is an attempt to explain the power dynamics of that kind of meeting. One of the things that this made me think of was the fact that we've had Ribsy get into fights before in Henry Huggins books, and these things worried me so much as a kid because all I could think of was that the dogs were going to seriously wound each other or get maimed. And I wonder, as I read these through now, whether Cleary had much concern about that at all. She seems to write about these things in a very matter-of-fact way.
Yeah.
But I felt worried for Ribsy again.
I think it serves the narrative a little well because you're never... You would worry as a person, but for Ribsy, this is a situation... Like, I don't know. Like, there's a blasé, a casualness to some of this that I assume is meant to sort of, like, inform the way Ribsy feels about it. Like, Ribsy doesn't worry beyond, like, the next 30 seconds because he's a dog. And so it's sort of just like, don't worry about what's coming up, readers. Stay in the moment. Stay in the moment with Ribsy. Like, Ribsy doesn't plan ahead much. Ribsy just takes an opportunity and goes for it.
So anyway, Ribsy does run into Mrs. Frawley, who is a widow living alone at the edge of town. And she takes him in. And one of the things that's funny about this book about this chapter is maybe three or four times Mrs. Frawley says, oh, it's another dog someone has taken to the edge of town to abandon.
Mm-hmm.
As though that were a regular occurrence, that she's constantly coming across these dogs.
Yeah. It also says a little bit about her.
What's that then?
That she's been taken to the edge of town to be abandoned.
Oh, well, yes, she is. So she takes Ribsy in, and as you mentioned, she wants to make a kind of a surrogate husband for herself, but
yeah,
she does that by feeding him, but also by clothing him, by putting a strange rhinestone collar on him, and by teaching him to sit up and smoke a pipe.
And pray.
And pray, and pray, yes.
She teaches him to pray. She teaches him to smoke a pipe, wear glasses and a hat.
Yes.
And
she does this all in part, as you mentioned, to be a big hit with her ladies' club.
And I'm going to stop right now and say, I love Lewis Darling to death. But... Someone asked him to draw a bunch of old women, and he said, I guess old women look like melting butter goblins, because that's exactly how he draws old women. They look like rubber Halloween masks that have been left out in the sun, and I assume that they're drawn that way to, like, show, like, this is how Ribsy is seeing this, like, sort of, like, exaggerated gawk. But it is a unsettling sight, all these, like, horrifying old women,
yeah,
with their jowls and their folds.
But Ribsy looks great in that picture.
That's a great picture of Ribsy. He looks miserable. He's mastered the art of drawing a miserable dog. So she's taught Ribsy to say his prayers and smoke his pipe, and the ladies club is very impressed.
Yep.
Like, they think this is the greatest thing in the world, and this is about the point where Ribsy escapes the house. He's gotten pretty overweight, too. Like, he's been with her for a while.
Yeah.
And she feeds him, like, table scraps, and he doesn't get it to go out to play. And this is where we also start seeing that he's not missing Henry Huggins. He's missing this sort of abstract interaction with boys. Like, he hears boys playing, and he's like, ooh, that's something I need. That's something I like. I want to be near these boys so I can play with them.
Right. That comes forth in the next chapter, where after a brief interlude of getting fed by various people on the way to on his way back into town, he wanders into a school. And the school just kind of puts up with him. There's like, oh great, here now our classroom has a dog.
I guess we have a dog now.
Which I find bewildering. Bewildering. And tell even more bewildering as the climax of this chapter, a boy brings his pet squirrel in.
I love his mother. So the boy brings his pet squirrel in for show and tell, and you can tell by the way she's written that the mother is just not, she's over this. She was over this the minute she had to bore holes in a box to bring the squirrel to school. She's just apologizing to the teacher the entire time for taking up all the class time. And I think the boy's mom is my favorite character in the book, because she's the most related. She's just the tired parent who didn't want to have to walk her kid into class that day.
You know, just the idea of keeping a squirrel as a pet. I cannot think of any mammal that is less apt as a pet, unless you're talking about a large predator.
because I do have a friend who keeps squirrels.
Really?
Like they will sit on his shoulder and like ride, or he will take them places. So it's possible.
Sure. I mean, one of the most famous paintings of the MFA by John Singleton Copley is a little boy with his pet flying squirrel. It's an amazing painting if you want to see it. And I understand people do this. It reminds me of, back when The Wonderful World of Disney was on, it seemed like every other live action Disney show was going to be a show about a kid who's adopted some unlikely wild animal, usually a raccoon.
A raccoon. What is the raccoon's called? Is that Rascal?
The Rascal, or it would be a coyote, or it would be something. And the thing that I loved about those was no matter what animal it was, there would come a point at the end of the episode where the boy realized he has to set the animal free.
Right.
And they would always have some gruff narrator, some Grizzly Adams type voice going, he knowed that animal was never going to belong to him, so he had to set him go.
Standards and practices probably said the only way you're allowed to see a boy cry on television is if he's saying goodbye to an animal. Is the only ways little boys were allowed to see another little boy cry on TV. And so Disney was required to just keep pairing them up with coyotes and deer and sick dogs so that they could tearfully say goodbye at the end of the episode. It was the only way they could deal with like absent parents. Like the dogs always had, I think the dogs always, these animals always represented loss of innocence, and they weren't allowed to show dead parents, so they just had to keep getting rid of animals.
Right. Now we're going far afield here from Ribsy, but as long as we're talking about Disney and squirrels, I discovered the other day one of the most horrifying things ever, which was there was a film in 1957 called Perry, which was about a squirrel. It was a live action Disney film about a squirrel. And what's remarkable about this film is whenever Perry had to deal with trouble, like a hawk or something like that, they would just film a squirrel being attacked by a hawk, and then when the hawk ate that squirrel, they would switch to another Perry.
Yeah.
And so they went through maybe a dozen squirrels making this film. And
that's efficient filmmaking.
I mean, I guess it was cheaper than having to train a squirrel each time.
Or to get complicated effects shots. Well, this squirrel is not eaten by a hawk, but it is almost eaten by a dog named Ribsy.
Yes.
Because you get this. Okay, so this scene where the squirrel obviously escapes its cage or whatever, and Ribsy goes nuts, barking and trying to get the squirrel. It goes on for about 100 pages as they try to. They try to get it in a jacket. They try to wrap it up in the flag or something. I don't remember. The principal gets involved. It's it goes, it's one of the chapters where I'm like, okay, she's just treading water here, because all that's going to happen is they're going to catch this squirrel. And then they do eventually catch the squirrel, but it is an adventure.
Yeah. And this does remind me again of some of those early Henry Huggins books, especially like the first Henry Huggins book, where she just didn't know how to get herself out of a scene.
Yeah, I remember you talking about that with Henry Huggins.
It's funny that that's happening at this point in her career. I mean, it's obvious that her main interest in this book is the characterization of Ribsy, and she does a great job with that. But plotting really suffers in this book, and it's interesting that that's the case, given that through her teen books, she was becoming very adept at following organic plots through the course of a novel.
Well, I think part of the problem is you have a central character who doesn't think ahead, isn't self-reflective, can't reason, and is completely impulsive. So Ribsy is almost entirely reactive to everything, and there has to be something for him to react to. Otherwise, he's just content to lay down.
Right.
And be comfortable. And so she keeps having to make Ribsy uncomfortable. And or dangle things in front of him that'll make him disruptive. And when it's a Henry Huggins book, you have the other kids around to sort of pull things forward. But when it's a Ribsy book, that's when the cracks really start to show, because you're just getting these incidents that don't necessarily add up to a lot.
So
he gets kicked out of school. Yes. And you get the principal saying, well, I guess letting you guys have a dog in the class wasn't a good idea after all. Which is true. Yeah, because he was adopted as their mascot. That was the big point of that story. So he's been owned by a bunch of giggly girls. He's been owned by an old lady who wants a companion. He's been owned by a group of kids who want a mascot. He doesn't fit into any of those slots. So the next, our next gentleman caller.
Right. A football game.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So there's a big football. This is probably my favorite incident in the book, is Ribsy sneaking into the football game, because this is the only time we get to see him be shrewd.
Right.
He plans to get into this game he fakes being asleep until he can sneak into the football game.
Yes, and the other thing that I love about this football game is that it's between Zachary Taylor High School and Chester A. Arthur High School.
Yeah,
and I kept trying to think to myself, is there a significance to these?
Is she making a political point?
But there was nothing I could tell other than they were just ridiculous long names of former presidents.
Yeah, don't they have like a cheer? There's like a cheer that the kids keep doing, like T-A-Y, T-T-T-A-Y, Y-Y-L-O-R, T-A-Y-L-O-R.
Taylor.
Taylor. Yes. Yep. I don't know if Chester A. Arthur had one. Hooray for Chester A. Arthur High. I guess that's all they say.
Right.
But yeah, see, I like this chapter because you get a good feel of what a high school football game kind of was like. In this era, it's kind of a community event. Like, everyone's going, everyone's excited. Like, it was a big deal for the two high schools to be up against each other. And Ribsy kind of feeds off that excitement. He also feeds off of hot dogs.
Lots and lots of hot dogs. Yes. The other thing that it reminds me of course, are all the Disney films about football playing. Donkeys and stuff such, because
I think there was only one, but,
well, but anytime an animal gets involved in a sporting event and someone says, well, there's no rule in the book about it, and because Ribsy's main contribution to this game is he trips a kid, who's before he can complete his play, and that stands as the official play.
Right. Isn't there like interference or something? Is that like, am I thinking of, is that football?
I mean, whatever. He's not on either team.
Right.
At that point, you have a ref is going to call and say, look, we got to redo that play.
Yeah. Like, there's a reason this game is divided up into sections. It's so that we can go back.
But no.
I think that's how football works.
But no, it stands. That's the way it works. And that bespeaks a kind of a more anarchic way of playing the sport. Where
but this,
like,
was 19, oh. This was 1964, too. This wasn't 1923.
Right.
Like, I'm sure that if you had looked in the rule book, there might have been something in there about, like, oh, something interfered with, like, something got on the field. Like, if a rock had been thrown onto the field, they would have been like, all right, let's go do that again because a kid tripped on this rock.
Right.
Yeah, but like you say, like, it's allowed to stand. And he's fated as the dog that saved the football game.
Right.
Gets his picture in the paper, he does.
Yep, yep. And he gets the attention of Joe Saylor.
Joe Saylor Jr., who grabs him and right. is like, this is my dog. The Saylors are a family that deserve their own book. I don't know if Joe should be the lead, but there's a lot going on with this family. I think this was the family that Beverly Cleary enjoyed writing the most.
Right.
Because they're the most vivid.
Now, just before we get to the Saylors, there is a little interlude here where Henry meets Beezus and Ramona, and it's kind of jarring because it's sort of like, oh yeah,
yeah,
all those kids back in Klickitat Street, and in just two or three pages, we get to see them all. They're just all up to their old stuff, you know. Ramona is out there stepping on cracks, and Beezus is worried.
Yeah.
And
but you
anyway.
Also you also are given the feeling like the kids aren't all let's all band together and go find Ribsy. Like they're reacting kinda as neighborhood kids would, which is, hey, you found your dog yet? No. Oh, that's a shame. We like seeing Ribsy. Oh well. Let's go hopscotch. Like, there's no, it's not sitcomized or anything. Like, Ribsy's is a missing dog, but he's not their missing dog, and they're just doing their thing.
Yeah, Beezus has moved on. She's already talking about Ribsy in the past tense.
Yeah, but he was such a nice dog. But I guess, I mean, that's probably the part of that thing, too, where, like, yeah, neighborhood dogs may just come and go. Like, I think that's part of, like, the community psyche. Like, they're not, it's not like someone died. It's the missing dog. We also get the wonderful line coming up. Mama, can we have pizza pie? Sorry. And the mother saying, it's after dark. And besides, I don't have money for pizza pie.
Yeah. People start talking like they're extras in the Time of Your Life or something like that.
I was going to say a Joe Orton play.
Yeah. Everyone is just like, becomes more and more like, hey, what you talking about? And everyone addresses everyone by their full name at the beginning of the scene so we know who they are.
Yep, yep. Joe Saylor Jr., do you mean to say you fed perfectly good hamburger to a dog? Why, that was our supper. Now what are we going to have? I'm like, yeah, they do. It's very these declarative statements. And he fed perfectly good hamburger to a stray dog. Sometimes I wonder what goes on in that boy's head.
Right.
And kids like dogs.
Here I scrimp and pitch to give you a piano lessons.
Yep. Now if that isn't just like a man, I have enough trouble buying groceries for four people and paying for Darlene's piano lessons and making payments on the TV without taking on a dog. They're fantastic.
Yep. And Darlene is doing the thing where she's twirling the piano stool up and down.
Now wait. Sorry. Look, I got troubles of my own. One of my best customers brings a dress in to be clean, and now I can't find the belt. If I don't find that belt by the time she comes in to get her dress this afternoon, I'm going to lose her business, and we can't afford that. That dog is gone, and we didn't starve, so forget it. Oh, anyway, I'm sorry. Yep. Darlene is twirling her piano.
Right. The only thing I mentioned about that is when I read this again just in advance of this podcast, that brought like a little tear to my eye because I remember those twirly piano stools. I don't know if they exist anymore. Everybody had them when I was young. That
yeah,
was,
we
that
don't
was
have. The, we have a. We have a bench. We have the solid
benches. Benches seem to have completely supplanted them. And let's face it, benches are better in every way. You
yeah,
put your sheet music in the bench and.
They are not height adjustable, though. That's the benefit of the like a little kid has to sit on that bench, and that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, the Sailors are an amazing family. But Joe Sailor is a terrible little kid.
Yes.
He wants Ribsy as his dog for no other reason than he just wants Ribsy. Like, he wants this thing.
Right.
And he calls his sister a pest, which is, I guess, like a nice callback to the Ramona world. But his family mocks him.
And in this chapter, we realize sort of what Cleary did plot-wise earlier in getting Ribsy's picture in the paper and Joe announcing to the reporter what his home address is so that Henry sees the picture and has the address and the number to call. Now, I don't understand what kind of a newspaper reporter is going around asking kids to give their personal information.
And their address. So yeah. And it's on the cover. I mean, it's a small town, but... Dog now, owned by boy.
And this is where, you know, where Joe really turns out to be a real stinker, because Henry obviously is Ribsy's owner and obviously knows everything about Ribsy. And Joe is just going to, like, string him along on the phone, like, how do you know this is your dog? And
here, though, is where the book, I thought the book was going to go in one direction, and it didn't. And this was my biggest disappointment in the book, because if we go all the way back to the beginning of this whole podcast, Ribsy was found by Henry, and Henry Huggins ended with Ribsy's actual owner arriving to take Ribsy back. And Henry kind of did the same thing. He was like, no, this is my dog now. No, you don't get to have Ribsy back. And sort of pulled that, fine, let's call the dog, and if the dog comes, like, Henry took another kid's dog once upon a time. And I thought that may be where Beverly Cleary was going with this. Like, but we never got any, there was never any callback to that. And I was kind of disappointed that Ribsy didn't, like, have a sudden thing where he was like, I've been here before. Or like, I remember this now. Like, right. or something. Like, I thought she was going to come full circle with it somehow. Or Ribsy was going to end up back with his original owner at the end or something.
Right. Well, this is that thing that happens in mainstream Hollywood movies where you're presented with a dilemma and then the screenwriter or the director is worried that this is too much for the audience to deal with, that they are too, it's hard to deal with feelings of ambivalence, and so they have to make one choice obviously a bad one. They have to, like, reveal something about a character that, like, you say, oh well, thank God she didn't choose him as her boyfriend because he's an asshole. Or sorry, I can't say that on this podcast. This is a podcast for kids. We'll bleep that out. He's a real jerk, you know. And so they make that. I feel like Cleary is trying to make it a little easier for her readers who might be concerned that perhaps this kid actually does like Ribsy.
Yeah.
And so she kind of blows that up.
Right. Yeah. This isn't Sister of the Bride. Like, there's not a lot of, like, ambiguity here as to, like, people's intentions. And I understand this is a book for much younger children than what we've kind of been reading. Yeah. But she really hammers it home that Joe's quite, as you put, the stinker in this situation. Because even though it is clear that Henry's the owner, he just strings him along. And so Henry's offering him, like, how much, like, $10?
$10. Which was five $100,000.
Yeah, I know. He could have. And even Joe's even like, I can buy a dozen dogs for that much. Like, I can go get a dog for nothing.
He could just go to the edge of town where people are right. dropping dogs all the time.
This is old lady who keeps kicking dogs. No, but, and that's when we sort of like, he's like, well, if he wants the dog this bad, I can just keep putting on the heat and get more stuff out of him.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, you're an awful boy.
And his dad isn't any better. His right. dad, his mom is saying, hey, who's that on the phone? And his dad is like, oh, let him handle it.
Yeah. Yeah. Let him cheat this kid.
Let him see how much he can get.
I didn't make a living. I didn't support this family with my dry cleaning business by treating customers with respect.
Maybe you can buy us all new hamburgers.
You want a pizza pie? You get a pizza pie out of that Huggins kid. And then, so it almost works because Henry's like, I'll call to Ribsy over the phone and I'll prove to you that it's my dog. And so he calls to Ribsy, and this is where you're like, oh, right, Ribsy's just a stupid animal. Because Ribsy hears Henry's voice and is like, well, he must be outside. And so he like runs to the door, and of course Darlene opens the door because she's a little thing just like everyone else in this family.
Yeah.
And Ribsy just bolts down the street like Yellow Dog does in Funny Farm.
Yeah.
And just takes off running and never looks back, trying to find the mysterious voice of Henry Huggins. Right. And this is a point where initially when I first read this book, I think I threw it across the room. Because I was like, are you kidding me? We're gonna have to go through another owner.
Yep.
And we do. And
we do.
This is weird because I in my memory, so I read this book like a year and a half ago or so just to Mitzi, and I had forgotten that Joe Saylor and Larry Biggerstaff were different characters. I had conflated them in my head. I thought this all kind of went together because they're both just kind of just boys. Right. But Ribsy runs and runs and runs to the deep, dark city.
Right. Now, this is another part where I get the feeling that Cleary is treating this like it's some sort of an ethnographic study. Like at the beginning of the book, when she had to explain what a shopping center is, uh-huh. It feels like she's having to explain what an apartment building is here.
Yeah. Okay.
And I'm like, wait a second. There've been apartment buildings have been a thing since the 19th century.
I'm wondering if she's just like, you know what? My books are being read by kids in the burbs. Like most of the kids who got access to my book, or maybe her publisher was like, these kids have never been in an apartment building. Like, that's not the kids who are going to this suburban library. Like, you gotta help them out here a little bit. Tell them what a fire escape is.
Yeah. I mean, Clary herself came from a very small farming community to Portland. And then she went to college in California. I'm sure this all must seem very strange to her.
Yeah.
But she really treats apartments like this is, you know, purgatory on Earth.
She treats them like they're a video game level too, yeah. Because the way it's described with Ribsy going up and down elevators, and also there's people running up and down the fire escapes, and there's different floors. But there's no people around. There's like the owner, the landlady. There's one woman who doesn't come into play at all. She's just there for like 1 second. And then there's Larry Biggerstaff. And it's Ribsy like trying to like run in and out of doors and run on floors and avoid like the bad guy, but also like find the good guy. It seems like elevator action, like the old Nintendo game. Like you're trying to get to the right level of this playing field. It doesn't feel like you're really in an apartment complex. And maybe it's because we're seeing it through Ribsy's eyes, and it's supposed to be this very unusual. It reads like the descriptions of the other world in like A Wrinkle in Time, where it's somewhat recognizable, but it's intentionally made weird and uncomfortable.
Also a book that features people playing with balls.
And unpleasant children.
Now,
Sorry. Poor Larry. I'm not the biggest A Wrinkle in Time fan. I'll go on record as saying that.
No, listeners out there who heard my sophomore lit podcast on Wrinkle in Time, you know I have mixed feelings about that book as well. But we're not here to talk about
no, we're not
here to trash talk Wrinkle in Time. We're here to trash talk Larry. This poor kid. When we're introduced to him, we're told that he's thin,
yeah,
and round-shouldered, and he's sitting on a front steps tossing a tennis ball from hand to hand.
Yep.
He's not even bouncing it against anything. he has no one to play with, but he doesn't even...
It doesn't bounce.
Right.
You had to throw it down hard to make it bounce at all. It was old and it lost much of its life, not unlike Mrs. Frawley. You had to throw it down hard to make it bounce at all. Go away, you old dog, he said crossly and muttered, I don't even have a good ball. And then Ribsy, a dumb animal that doesn't understand how telephone works, has to teach the boy how to play with a ball. That's the next thing that happens in this pathetic little chapter.
Yes.
Yeah, and that literally happens. Ribsy trains the boy how to play catch with the ball.
I guess it's like Maria teaching the Van Traps how to sing again, or something like that. It's really strange because on the one hand, it's rough. On the other hand, it's so ridiculous that you have a hard time knowing what the tone you're supposed to approach this with is.
Right. You keep expecting, like, the yellow kid to come from around the corner. Like, it's that kind of situation.
Holly G.
Here come the cats and jammer kids. Here's Captain and the kids. What are they getting up to? What's Larry up to? Oh, looks like Fritz stole his ball.
Yes, they need to have there needs to be a picture here that Lois Darling draws of all the laundry just rung between the two buildings. And
yeah, it's a good thing that Larry doesn't live in a building with a wicked old witch. Oh wait, he does. He lives with old lady Creech.
Yes.
Yeah, I hazard to call this chapter the magical realism of the Ribsy novel. But yeah. we're rapidly descending into the abyss here with the horror that is Larry Biggerstaff's life. Right. He lives in an apartment building. He gets in trouble from his mom because he's a lonely kid. He doesn't have anyone to play with. He tries to make his own fun, and that gets him in trouble with the woman who runs the apartment manager, because he's always noisy and she doesn't like noisy kids. And she certainly doesn't like dogs.
Right.
So of course he does the smart thing and he lets the dog into the apartment building.
Right. And there is a kind of an attempt at sort of wacky, I don't know, like a Chaplin-esque style humor where he has to push Ribsy onto an elevator and Ribsy comes up the elevator without him there, runs into a woman who just says, oh, hi, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
You know, I have to say, though, I once had an experience like this where at the house that I'm currently living, the doorbell rang and I went there to answer it. Usually when the doorbell rings, that means a package has been dropped off or something. And I opened the door and there was a cat staring right up at me. And it was the strangest thing ever. We determined that actually someone had come and left a package on the step, rang the doorbell. And in the time that it took me to get to the door, the cat had run up onto the porch. But that was our introduction to the local cat. And
we believe that happened.
And the cat has shown up several times since then. We don't have a house cat right now, so whenever the cat, whose name is Kelly, shows up, we let him in. And,
but how do you know the cat's name is Kelly?
Because it's on a collar, a tag on the collar.
Okay.
And we've let him in several times, and he wanders around the house. He contents himself to know that he's the only animal there, and then he wanders out again.
So Ribsy barks on the elevator, which alerts Mrs. Horror Show, whatever her name is, Mrs. Berg. Or no, Mrs. Berg is the nice woman.
Mrs. Creech.
That there, so it alerts to her that there's a dog in the building. This woman, Mrs. Berg, opens the door and sees Ribsy, and she goes, "Hello, how did you manage to press the button?" And later on says, the manager says, "Good morning, Mrs. Berg. I was looking for a dog in the elevator." And Mrs. Berg says, "There's no dog in the elevator." And I'm like, yeah, there was. Like, you can say that, but there definitely was a dog barking in this apartment complex. But that seems to be enough to, like, put the manager's, like, mind at ease.
Well, maybe Mrs. Creech is so awful because people keep gaslighting her.
She lives in this haunted apartment building with only two tenants. Yeah, I don't know. Like, this, it's such an each chapter kind of exists in its own book. And yeah. This is one of the, you said it's Chaplin-esque, but yeah, it tries a little hard to be wacky, and introduce these sort of wacky characters. I don't know. Maybe she was trying, like, maybe this was just a series of backdoor pilots for her. And she was like, any one of these chapters can be spun off into its own series. And, right. And at the end of the day, her publisher was like, hard pass.
Yeah, but six pages from the end of this book, she's still introducing characters. She's got these guys, Bert, and right. And what's the other guy's name? I don't know, but he's introduced. The one guy's introduced as a body and fender man.
Yep,
and he's just there to be kind of Ralph Cramden or something. And
yeah, you get these like workers, Bert and. Not Larry, that's the boy. I can't think of it. There's these two guys, and they sort of like... So Ribsy gets on the fire escape and can't get down, which I love, because that's tough on a dog. Like, those are weird stairs, and there's, like, a grate, and Ribsy is, like, just in a foreign land. Like, he can't get down. Now, here's the part of the book that made me almost throw it against the wall again, which is that Henry shows up. Like, there's no... Ribsy is in a random part of town on a fire escape, and Henry has gotten into his, like, they're like, well, if he ran out of that boy Joe Saylor's house, he must be in the city somewhere. Let's just drive around. And then Henry just happens to hear Ribsy bark on the fire escape, and that's how he finds him.
Well, maybe there were only like six streets in Portland in the 1960s.
Because that's it. Like, that's... He finds Ribsy, and then there's like a fun shenanigans as they have to like help Ribsy actually get down.
Right. But we also get treated to the most hack jokes Cleary has ever written, when Henry is trying to explain to these two exiles from the Money for Nothing video why Ribsy is here, and he's trying to explain how Ribsy went through all these things, and the one man turns to the other and says, "Poor kid, too much TV, you know?
Yeah.
All we need is a bum in the street in the alley, like looking up at Ribsy and like pouring out his bottle of whiskey."
Because it's that thing that makes me so infuriated in books, in movies, in writing, where when someone says, that's your dog, kid? How'd that dog get up there? And instead of Henry saying, he ran away from home and he ended up with this boy and then he ran off again and I'm just trying to get my dog down, Henry goes, he ran away and got a bubble bath and then he was in the newspaper and I talked to him on the phone. And you're like, why would you describe your experience like that? Like, why would you say the only things that people are going to be like, that's not how narratives work. B, we didn't need to know that information. See, you're only saying that so that we can respond like, that's the craziest story I ever heard, kid. Like, it's very contrived, this ending. And it does just lead up to a whole bunch of more physical comedy where they have to get Ribsy down.
But you're right. The weird thing is, counterbalanced against that is an actually well-imagined depiction of a dog trying to walk on a fire escape, and it works just about as well as you would imagine it would for a dog to be walking on a fire escape, and that all is interesting.
Yeah, it's like that's the part that actually is gripping. Like, oh god, this poor dog has little feet, has never been on this kind of surface before, and is in danger of falling. That's drama. And instead, they bring in this whole, like, more... It's like she was like, I just got to bring in more characters.
Well, also, once again, Henry's parents bail him out because his dad is the one who runs and gets a stepladder.
All right.
And he's the one who's going to... There's a lot of this... There's a lot of other contrivances here where everyone's like saying, well, who's going to go after Ribsy?
Yeah.
And the parents want to do the reasonable thing and call the fire department. And Larry says, oh, you can't do that because Mrs. Creech will have it out for me. But as far as I can tell, all that Mrs. Creech is going to do is complain to his mom.
Right.
And I don't know what that's going to do.
Well, right, because I guess they introduced that as a plot point just to build some kind of tension, because once Henry and his parents show up, you're like, oh, we're done. Like, they're not going to look up there and be like, well, that dog's a little too high for us to reach. I guess we got to leave the dog up there, Henry. Let's go home. Like, you know that Henry and Ribsy are now reunited. So they introduce, Beverly Cleary introduces this whole thing with the manager just so someone has something at stake. And even that doesn't pay off, though. Like, what happens? Like, do they buy him a new ball? I can't remember how it ends.
You know, at the end, they offer, they Henry wants to give Larry some of reward money because of his part in getting Ribsy back to him, which is kind of a tenuous connection, to be honest. But they eventually are able to give him $3, and Larry says, I can get a new ball.
That's right. I can get a new ball. Now, they could have just given him the $10 and Larry could have had a ball and maybe a dinner.
No.
He is the thinnest boy in the town. I thought that was like, I was like, oh, they're going to give him the $10 because they came with it.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, nope. No, even though Larry's a much nicer kid than that Joe Saylor Jr. ever was, they give him. They're like, they could be like, well, we'll give him three of it. Give him three. He'd just lose it anyway.
Now you have me picturing that after this book is over, there's a gold rush scene where it's Larry cooking the old tennis ball, and pulling it out, and slowly eating it.
No, there's a scene afterwards where like. They're driving back home with Ribsy, and Mr. Huggins is like, well, we got $7. Want to go out for burgers?
For pizza pie.
Pizza pie. And the moral of the story, the end of the story is the dog can ride in the car now. Like, the dog's allowed to ride in the car now.
But it was the dog riding in the car that caused the problem in the,
first place. Yeah, leave the dog at home.
They should have stuck to their guns and... kept him at home. I don't know.
And that's it. That's your book. It's a... I know I rag on it a lot. I actually... There's a lot that I enjoy about this book.
Yeah.
A lot of the POV stuff. Ribsy is a compelling character. Like, I think Beverly Cleary proves in this that there is a way to write an animal as an animal and still make it a compelling character. But a lot of that has to do with really digging into their alien mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree, and it's just a really fascinating it's fascinating to think of Cleary. There's a lot of possibilities in this book that Cleary did not pursue.
Uh-huh.
You know, Beverly Cleary immediately turns around from this and does The Mouse and the Motorcycle, which is a completely different book about animals and a completely different kind of plotting story. And it will be interesting to talk about, but you know, there is, in spite of the zaniness, in spite of the broadness, what I see in this is a kind of a commitment to trying to towards more realism. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that will come out certainly in the Ramona books, though those are books that are much more naturalistic than anything that Cleary did before that. And I think that even this, we've been ragging on this apartment chapter. I get the feeling that Cleary was trying to actually depict realistically as she could what she thought apartment life was like. I don't think she had any experience with it.
No.
But she was trying to kind of like stretch her legs and get a little bit out of the suburbs and get a little bit out of middle class kids.
No, I agree. And I think her geography is a little wonky in the book. I think she jumps around a lot. I think that she has a few more misses than usual in her late in this era of her writing. But looking at it in context and looking at what she's doing and what's coming up, I agree that I see her as a writer experimenting with narratives and experimenting with characters and points of view that I think is going to, it's necessary for what she ends up doing in the later part of her career, which is draw characters who are blindingly realistic and with inner lives that are like just even at their most staid are heart-wrenching and believable and who have personal journeys that make narrative sense and are very satisfying. And I think she had to experiment around a lot at this stage in order to sort of like stretch her muscles and get ready for that next phase in her career.
If I were able to interview Beverly Cleary, first of all, I would be so tongue-tied I wouldn't be able to speak. But if I had the ability to speak, I would be curious to ask her what she was thinking at this point and where she thought things were going. Because I know you and I, we can speculate on this a lot. It really does feel like something was up. And she was... I'm curious to know why she stopped doing the teen books. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know why she returned to characters that she'd already created instead of continuing to move on in different directions. And of course, the Mouse and the Motorcycle is going to be an interesting detour here too.
To say the least. It's a... It's also, I believe, the first book of hers to receive a television adaptation.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, that's it. We're going to jump right into like her, like she's going to suddenly get commercial. And it's funny because we were discussing the wackiness of this book. And as I was trying to find a passage, I accidentally flipped to the back. And this is a later copy I have. So it has a bunch of like an ads for a bunch of her books. And the one I landed on as we were discussing like the wackiness of Joe Saylor's family was Dear Mr. Henshaw. And it momentarily made me tongue-tied because it's amazing that the person who wrote Ribsy wrote Dear Mr. Henshaw and the person who wrote even Sister of the Bride or 15 wrote Dear Mr. Henshaw, which is also a book about teens, but is a very different feel. And I love the fact that we're able to look at these books in context of her entire career, because it's making a lot as odd as a book as Ribsy is, and as odd of a book as The Mouse and the Motorcycle is coming up, it's making more sense to me from a development perspective and an artistic perspective. And it's also just demonstrating that she wrote a lot of different things over her career.
You know, I mentioned when we finished Henry in the Clubhouse that felt bittersweet to me, because that felt to me like the end of the Henry era. Now, this is a book that is, I guess, part of the Henry era, but it never felt like that to me. And so I don't have the same kind of mixed emotions finishing this book, but I do feel confused.
Well, I described it as a coda to the series.
Yeah.
Like the series had a very satisfying ending, and this is kind of this little like sort of reflective additional book that really, it's like, you enjoyed that series? I'm going to reframe it for you just a little bit, just so you know that like there was always more going on this entire time than you were aware of. And it wasn't very deep, but there was more going on. There were characters we never really got to meet, and here's one of them. And I don't know, it's not part of the series. I don't consider it part of the series proper, but it's a nice little, like, just little sting at the end. Yeah, and it's also a nice transitional book. Like, we're going into another phase of her career now, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, of course, if you're a kid reading these books, you just read them in the order that you find them, right, on the shelf at the library. So all of what we say is the ruminations of two nerds who have decided to read everything that Clary wrote.
I mean, for all we know, Socks could have been the transitional book in her period. And again, that's a Beverly Clary book I've only ever read once, and that was, I think, in fourth grade. So that's one I haven't revisited in a while.
Well, I haven't reread The Mouse and the Motorcycle since I was, I believe, 8. So I'm looking forward to this.
I haven't read The Mouse and the Motorcycle in about 2 months. So it's I can't wait to talk about it.
Okay. Well, next time.
Next time.
Click It Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast, is on the Incomparable Network. For more information, visit theincomparable.com.